Picture this, if you will. You're a primary care physician reviewing the lab results of a 59-year-old female during her annual physical. And you tell her that, based on her elevated hemoglobin A1c, she's developed diabetes mellitus. Your patient is visibly upset, and you ask her about her concerns. "I know diabetes is a death sentence," she says. "I watched my uncles fall apart piece by piece. One was blind and on dialysis for years, and the other had his foot amputated. Is that what's going to happen to me?" As you listen to your patient, you consider how to counsel her about the chronic complications of diabetes mellitus. And welcome to AudioBricks. I'm Arjun Iyer, bringing topics in endocrinology from our bricks to your ears. But first, a quick shout out to the learning platform that makes AudioBricks possible, the RX Bricks, which is the source of all the content you hear on this podcast. And if you've been holding off on checking it out, well, now we're running the Bricks Season Pass campaign. If you follow the link in the show notes below, you can get 3 months of Bricks for the price of one, or a full year of Bricks for the price of 3 months. And simply clicking on the link helps support AudioBricks and the work we do to bring you this podcast, so we'll be happy if you even just take a look. After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Explain the major cellular mechanisms that cause the chronic complications of diabetes mellitus. 2. Describe the manifestations and management of diabetic macrovascular disease, especially coronary artery disease. 3. Describe the pathophysiology, diagnosis, and management of diabetic retinopathy. 4. Describe the pathophysiology, diagnosis, and management of diabetic nephropathy. And 5. Describe the presentation, pathophysiology, and management of diabetic neuropathy. Part 1. What are the chronic complications of diabetes mellitus? The diagnosis of diabetes mellitus, whether type 1 or type 2, implies a predisposition to disorders affecting almost every organ system in the body. Some develop slowly over years, usually 5 to 10 years of poorly controlled disease, and can lead to blindness, renal failure, and myocardial infarctions. The good news is that many can be prevented or slowed by meticulous control of blood glucose levels and detected through screening tests before major morbidity occurs. If, that is, you know what you're looking for. Since many of these complications stem from injury to the blood vessels, they've been traditionally divided up by macrovascular and microvascular disease. Macrovascular complications, like the name suggests, are those that affect major arteries, like coronary artery disease, peripheral artery disease, and stroke. Now, diabetes isn't the only risk factor for these diseases, but it's a major player. Microvascular complications are those that affect the small vessels, like arterioles and capillaries, and include diabetic retinopathy, nephropathy, and neuropathy. Part 2. How does diabetes mellitus damage tissues? Whether by type 1 or type 2 diabetes, chronic hyperglycemia is the major cause of tissue injury in diabetes. And the most important mechanism of injury is something called non-enzymatic glycation. Non-enzymatic glycation refers to the alteration of body proteins by high glucose concentrations in the blood. As it turns out, sugar is not only delicious and full of energy, it's also highly reactive, forming spontaneous bonds with proteins and, to a lesser extent, nucleotides and lipids. And the attachment of a sugar molecule onto a protein or other molecule often impairs its function. These altered molecules are known as advanced glycation end products. And these can have several detrimental effects. Advanced glycation end products increase vascular permeability, increase arterial stiffness, oxidize LDL cholesterol that deposits in atherosclerotic plaques, and induce secretion of various cytokines. All this leads to further inflammation, altered vascular permeability, and the various manifestations of macro and microvascular disease. Now, an important clinical example of an advanced glycation end product is glycated hemoglobin. When hemoglobin binds glucose in the blood, it forms glycated hemoglobin, or HbA1c. And since red blood cells have an average lifespan of 120 days, the HbA1c provides an estimate of the average blood glucose levels over 3 months. Important, if your patient's one of those who treats the lab work like a report card and tries to be good about their glucose management only when they're about to get their lab work drawn. All right, pop quiz time. What is the term for the process by which abundant glucose in the blood spontaneously binds to organic molecules? And the answer is, of course, non-enzymatic glycation. A less common mechanism of hyperglycemic injury is sorbitol-mediated injury that occurs in cells of the lens, retina, and peripheral nerves. These cells convert glucose to sorbitol once it enters the cell, which is a cool trick because once you convert intracellular glucose, you now have a lower concentration, and the concentration gradient continues to favor the passive transport of glucose into the cell. Unfortunately, since sorbitol can't actually leave the cell on its own, hyperglycemia causes sorbitol to build up inside the cell, causing toxic osmotic injury to cells as they blow up like little water balloons. And this occurs in addition to the oxidative damage also caused by glucose. The second major mechanism of tissue injury in diabetes is by systemic inflammation. The activation of T cells by inflammatory cytokine release contributes to a lot of the complications of diabetes, especially accelerated atherosclerosis. You know, the one that causes macrovascular complications like coronary artery disease and stroke. And although the role of cytokines in microvascular complications is less certain, interleukins 1, 6, 18, and tumor necrosis factor alpha have been implicated in the development of diabetic nephropathy. That's for you immunology nerds out there. And the inflammatory cascade can contribute to microvascular disease in other ways as well. In small blood vessels, inflammation may lead to platelet aggregation, which decreases blood flow and can cause tissue ischemia. Inflammation is even implicated in the onset of type 2 diabetes. Cytokine expression is one reason why obesity is linked to type 2 DM. Obesity leads to the production of cytokines like tumor necrosis factor alpha and IL-6 by fat cells, promoting insulin resistance in most cells in the body. Part 3. What are the macrovascular complications of diabetes mellitus? Macrovascular diabetic disease, like we mentioned, refers to the accelerated atherosclerosis caused by diabetes, leading to chronic stenosis of the large arteries, as well as acute occlusion by plaque rupture. It's why patients with diabetes have unusually high rates of coronary artery disease, peripheral artery disease, and stroke. But of all of these, coronary artery disease, or CAD, is perhaps the most consequential complication of diabetes mellitus, especially in patients with poorly controlled disease. How consequential, you ask? Well, to give you an idea, the American Heart Association recommends that diabetes be considered a CAD risk equivalent instead of merely a risk factor. In English, this means that for the purposes of assessing risk, all patients with diabetes are treated as if they actually had coronary artery disease for the purposes of assessing risk. Now, you can read more about this in the brick on coronary artery disease, but if we're talking about complications to expect in diabetic patients, it's worth at least reviewing the clinical presentation. So, what symptoms would you expect in a diabetic patient with coronary artery disease? The classic symptoms of angina pectoris include pressure-like substernal chest pain on exertion that gets better with rest or nitroglycerin, and is associated with symptoms like shortness of breath, nausea, dizziness, and profuse sweating. The more serious acute coronary syndrome can present with accelerating frequency of chest pain and even chest pain at rest. Now, these are often symptoms referred to as typical anginal chest pain, but if I had a nickel for every myocardial infarction I diagnosed in the absence of typical symptoms, well, I'd have a lot of nickels. Patients with diabetes specifically often present with non-specific symptoms, like only nausea or only dyspnea. And this may be partly due to diabetic neuropathy that diminishes visceral sensation, so they don't actually feel that crushing chest pain sensation. Unfortunately, this means that myocardial infarctions often go unrecognized, leading to higher rates of sudden arrhythmias and other late complications of untreated MIs in this population. So patients with diabetes who have even vague symptoms of chest pain or dyspnea, or even just have abnormal resting EKGs, should be screened for coronary artery disease. But the best treatment, as in many cases, is prevention. Control blood glucose aggressively to minimize the risk of CAD, ideally achieving a hemoglobin A1c less than 7%. Now, it's worth noting that diabetes mellitus is such a major risk factor that even with well-controlled glucose levels and no symptoms, you can't exclude future cardiac events in this population. I mean, obviously it helps, but these patients are still at increased risk. So physicians have to treat cardiovascular risk factors like hyperlipidemia and hypertension a lot more aggressively in this population. First, statins are recommended for all patients with diabetes age 40 to 70 years old, regardless of their LDL cholesterol levels, because these are the years of peak incidence of morbidity and mortality from cardiovascular disease. Younger patients are at lower risk, so statin therapy for them is initiated only with elevated LDL. Older patients don't have as many years of their life left to lose, so statin therapy is often individualized, balancing side effects and benefits. What? I'm not saying it to be mean. It's just true. Second, blood pressure control has to be more aggressive in patients with diabetes than in the general hypertensive population. The American Diabetic Association recommends that blood pressure be controlled to less than 130 over 80 millimeters mercury in patients with diabetes mellitus, as opposed to 140 over 90 that's usually recommended. Of note, therapy often starts with an angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor, or ACE inhibitor. ACE inhibitors not only have protective effects on the heart, but also the kidneys and eyes as well, making them particularly valuable for patients with diabetes and proteinuria and early retinopathy. Finally, preventive low-dose aspirin should be prescribed if the patients have established coronary artery disease, as in all patients. But the antiplatelet agent clopidogrel may be equally effective with fewer side effects. Time for a quick knowledge check. What are the preferred drugs for treating hypertension in patients with diabetes mellitus? ACE inhibitors are preferred for their cardioprotective and renal protective effects. Part 4. What is diabetic retinopathy? If coronary artery disease is the most common macrovascular complication of diabetes, diabetic retinopathy is the most common microvascular complication. To get a sense of the scale, it affects up to 80% of patients who've had diabetes for at least 20 years and leads to around 10,000 new cases of blindness every year in the United States. And while early stages are asymptomatic, the disease can progress to cause symptoms of floaters, blurred vision, visual distortion, and progressive vision loss. While the precise mechanism of retinopathy is unknown, those advanced glycation end products, or AGEs, that seem to cause shenanigans just about everywhere else, are definitely part of the problem. In diabetic retinopathy, they cause thickening of the basement membranes of the retinal vessels, causing microvascular stenoses that lead to ischemic damage, especially to the macula. Additionally, the high blood glucose acts as an osmol that causes retinal blood vessels to swell and leak, leading to macular edema. Tiny clots of exudates can form and cause floaters to appear in the visual fields. In advanced disease, new blood vessels often form in the retina. And you might think this is good news in an otherwise ischemic eye. Only problem is, these new vessels are fragile and often bleed into the vitreous, causing floaters and forming scar tissue that can ultimately lead to a detached retina. Since diabetic retinopathy is such a common cause of morbidity in diabetes, annual screening is recommended for all diabetic patients so you can catch the disease early. Although this can be done in a primary care office, diabetes guidelines suggest an annual visit to the ophthalmologist, who can dilate the pupil and use better equipment to perform fundoscopy. On fundoscopic exam, clinicians look for proliferation of blood vessels, most noticeable near the optic disc, hemorrhages, which appear as bloody streaks on the retina, and exudates, which appear as yellowish patches. They're almost the color of the optic disc, but scattered across the retina. Glycemic and blood pressure control are the best means of preventing retinopathy, and I know I sound like a broken record for telling you this for every complication, but seriously, the treatment modalities for advanced diabetic retinopathy are horrifying. For macular edema and proliferation of retinal blood vessels, ophthalmologists inject anti-VEGF agents that inhibit angiogenesis, like directly into the eyeball. Retinal hemorrhages and blood vessel proliferation can be treated with laser photocoagulation, where they literally blast your retinal vessels through your pupil. And finally, if your posterior chamber is so full of hemorrhage that you can barely see, an ophthalmologist might just say, screw it, and scoop out the insides of your eyeball. It's technically called a vitrectomy, and they literally scoop out the vitreous humor that fills your eyeball and replace it with saline or something. So yeah, good habits are hard to maintain, but if you threaten your patients with the possibility of regularly getting stabbed in the eyeball with injections, getting their eye blasted out with a laser, or having the insides of their eyeball scooped out, well, maybe now diet and exercise sounds like a better option. Alright, quiz time. How is diabetic retinopathy diagnosed? Diabetic retinopathy is diagnosed on fundoscopic exam of the retina, preferably through a dilated pupil, looking for vascular proliferation, hemorrhages, or exudates. Part 5. What is diabetic nephropathy? Along with hypertension, diabetes is one of the most common causes of chronic kidney disease in the United States. It occurs in up to 25% of patients with diabetes mellitus, with an onset generally after about 10 years of disease, or sooner if glycemic control is poor. And like all forms of chronic kidney disease, it's initially asymptomatic, but progresses in an orderly, relentless way. It typically starts with very small amounts of protein in the urine, or microalbuminuria, and sensitive assays can detect the threshold of 50 milligrams of albumin in the urine in 24 hours. But the amount of proteinuria typically increases steadily and can be classified as macroalbuminuria at over 300 milligrams per 24 hours, and even nephrotic range proteinuria at over 3.5 grams. Like any glomerular disease, advanced diabetic nephropathy causes progressive worsening of renal function that can result in end-stage renal disease. And at the later stages, patients often experience symptoms like edema, fatigue, and nausea. So, how do the glomeruli get damaged? Well, you already know the starting point. AGE formation, cytokine release, yada yada yada. But the combination of tissue-damaging factors results in two main patterns of tissue injury visible on light microscopy: mesangial matrix expansion and thickening of the glomerular basement membrane. Thickening of the basement membrane is easier to conceptualize. Like with diabetic retinopathy, the extracellular matrix surrounding the microvasculature thickens, causing loss of blood flow, breakage, and leakage. That's actually how albumin gets into the urine, by leaking through the damaged membrane. Mesangial matrix expansion refers to the accumulation of large clumps of extracellular matrix proteins in the space between the tufts of the glomerular capillaries. You can actually see these on microscopy. The clumps of pink acellular material in the middle of the glomeruli when viewed using a standard H&E stain. And they're called Kimmelstein-Wilson nodules. Eventually, increased glomerular capillary pressure and hemodynamic damage cause glomerular sclerosis and loss of kidney function. The key with diabetic nephropathy is to detect this disease early, at the stage of microalbuminuria where there's protein in the urine, but the actual renal function isn't yet decreased. The way to detect nephropathy is with an annual test for urine albumin. Now, the gold standard is to collect a whole 24 hours worth of the patient's urine, but more commonly, clinicians just use a spot albumin test. That's where you use the ratio of urine albumin to urine creatinine as a good estimate for the 24-hour amount. Remind me again. How much albumin in a 24-hour sample is described as microalbuminuria? 30 to 300 milligrams. Good. Now, the reason early detection is important is partly so you can hound your patients about keeping tight control of, say it with me, blood sugar and blood pressure. But it's also important because microalbuminuria can actually be reversed by treating the patients with ACE inhibitors. And that's not true with later disease. At that stage, we can slow down the progress of disease, but not prevent it. End-stage renal disease, of course, can only be treated with dialysis or renal transplantation. Part 6. What is diabetic neuropathy? When everyone thinks of diabetic neuropathy, they think of people who can't feel their toes. But diabetes mellitus affects both the peripheral and autonomic nervous systems. Let's start with the one that everyone's more familiar with. Peripheral neuropathy is the presence of symptoms or signs of peripheral nerve dysfunction caused by diabetes. Clinically, diabetic neuropathy is diagnosed in diabetic patients with the classic symptoms after the exclusion of other causes. Nerve damage may present as sensory motor polyneuropathy, pure sensory neuropathy, or mononeuropathy. Sensory symptoms commonly include paresthesias that result in an electrical or burning type foot pain, tingling, or numbness, often in a stocking glove distribution. The severity of these complications depend on how well the blood glucose is controlled and how long the diabetes has been present. But the first signs of diabetic neuropathy often start well before the patient's aware of it, even during pre-diabetes. The progressive sensory and motor loss put the patient at risk for minor trauma that goes unnoticed and heals poorly because of impaired peripheral circulation. The end result is diabetic foot ulcers that can become infected with nasty bacteria like Pseudomonas. And they can even make their way all the way down to the bone, where they cause osteomyelitis. Diabetic arthropathy, weirdly enough, is arthritis of the feet and ankles that's thought to be at least partly neurologic in origin. It's from the lack of proprioception that subjects the joints to additional strain and trauma, much like the microtrauma that causes the foot ulcers. But it may also be related to bone abnormalities due to the problems with microcirculation. Now, the precise cause of neuropathy isn't completely known, but sorbitol and AGE damage of myelinated nerves and Schwann cells is probably at least part of the picture. Oxidative injury to the small arteries supplying to the nerves may also contribute, meaning that while diabetic neuropathy has been historically considered a microvascular complication, direct injury to the nerves may actually be more important. Now, because patients are often unaware of the early stages of diabetic neuropathy, sensation should be checked annually. Vibration using a tuning fork, pain sensation using pinprick, and light touch using a monofilament. Additionally, the clinician should check for any skin changes, muscle and ligament changes, poor wound healing, ulcers, and fungal infections of the toenails or in between the toes during the yearly foot exam. All right, pop quiz time. What is the most common complication of peripheral neuropathy? The answer is diabetic foot ulcers. Now, to avoid foot ulcers, patients should be taught to do weekly foot exams at home, to wear comfortable footwear, and to avoid walking with bare feet, especially if a screening exam reveals a subtle sensory deficit. For those who experience pain associated with diabetic neuropathy, there's a variety of pharmacologic agents, including pregabalin, duloxetine, and gabapentin as first-line agents. And finally, diabetic arthropathy can be treated with casting. Now let's talk about autonomic neuropathy, the one everyone forgets about. This form of diabetic neuropathy leads to autonomic dysfunction of both the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems, causing a range of potentially disabling symptoms. Most commonly, this leads to either increased or decreased GI motility. The classic complication is gastroparesis, where the passage of food from the stomach to the duodenum is delayed, but this can also manifest as either constipation or diarrhea. Urinary retention or incontinence are also relatively common. And autonomic neuropathy can even affect the cardiovascular system, resulting in resting tachycardia, exercise intolerance, and orthostatic hypotension. And this last one can be dangerous, leading to falls and significant trauma, especially in the elderly. Like with peripheral neuropathy, it's important to rule out other reversible causes of autonomic neuropathy before you attribute it to diabetes. For example, patients with hypotension need an ECG and cardiac evaluation to look for heart failure. Those with GI symptoms need endoscopy to look for ulcers, and those with bladder dysfunction may benefit from cystoscopy. To diagnose gastroparesis, a gastric emptying study is the gold standard, where a patient ingests a radioisotope to follow the progress of a meal through the upper GI tract. The management of autonomic neuropathy depends on the specific manifestations. For orthostatic hypotension, options include compression stockings and physical therapy, including resistance exercises. In severely symptomatic patients, you can use drugs that increase vascular tone, like midodrine. Diabetic gastroparesis, unfortunately, is difficult to treat. Medications that may be useful for severe nausea include metoclopramide, diphenhydramine, and ondansetron, but all of them have side effects that may limit their use. As always, it's better to practice good prevention rather than wait until you have something to treat. And that's our show. Let's review what you learned about the many complications of diabetes mellitus. First, can you name the two major categories of complication of diabetes? Complications of diabetes mellitus are often categorized as macrovascular and microvascular disease. Second, which macrovascular complication of diabetes mellitus has the greatest morbidity and mortality? And how do you manage diabetic patients differently to prevent this complication? The macrovascular complication with the greatest morbidity and mortality is coronary artery disease. Patients with diabetes need to control other risk factors for CAD more tightly than others, with blood pressure goal less than 130 over 90, broader use of statin therapy, and preferential use of ACE inhibitors as antihypertensive therapy for their cardioprotective effects. Third, can you list three other complications of diabetes that do not fall into the category of macrovascular disease? You know, the ones classically referred to as microvascular complications? Diabetic retinopathy, nephropathy, and neuropathy all used to be classified as microvascular complications, but as we learn more about them, the pathophysiology appears to involve more than just the vasculature. Next, what screening test is typically used to detect the earliest stages of diabetic nephropathy? Screening for nephropathy is done by urine microalbumin test. Between 50 and 300 milligrams of excreted albumin per day is considered microalbuminuria. And the advantage of early screening is that with the use of ACE inhibitors, you can actually reverse the microalbuminuria before it progresses to chronic kidney disease. Finally, what is the most important preventive strategy for all complications of diabetes mellitus? All of these complications can be prevented with tight glycemic control, and most also benefit from tight blood pressure control. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's get back to that patient from the intro. You've just diagnosed a 59-year-old female with diabetes mellitus, and she expresses concern about complications she's seen in her own family members. How would you address her concerns and use this as an opportunity to educate her further? Pause the video if you need some time to think. You acknowledge to your patient that diabetes mellitus can cause damage to major arteries in the body, as well as in the eyes, kidneys, and nerves. Sugars provide a lot of quick energy, you tell her, but when there's too much sugar in the blood for a long time, they tend to stick to the insides of your body and mess them up pretty good. You reassure her, however, that by keeping her blood sugar and blood pressure under control, she can significantly reduce the risk of developing these complications. She breathes a sigh of relief. That's good, she says, because I know my uncle always forgot to take his meds. You assure her that you'll work together, with lifestyle measures and medications, to keep her blood sugar in a healthy range and avoid such complications. And that's our show. Make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you like what you heard. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. And again, now it's your chance to take advantage of the Brick Season Pass offer by following the link in the show notes below. It's a huge discount on the written materials that serves as the foundation of Audio Bricks, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already, and help keep Audio Bricks free. Until next time, friends.